interesting situation. It's one of the most diverse nations. Some people say the most diverse nation in the world, with the numbers of people that we have from around the globe, and that represents different ethnic traditions, religious traditions, all kinds of different folks that populate the America that we live in today. Today what we're going to do are a couple of different things. We've got a few things. I want to return briefly to yesterday's case study to kind of do a little bit of follow-up on the questions. Then I'd like to take a look at the word dialogue, the idea of dialogue, the process of interreligious dialogue, and kind of lay out briefly what is involved in that. How is that term defined? And then we'll move on for the bulk of today to the case study on the Muslim taxi drivers at the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. All right. So yesterday we talked about the National Day of Prayer being celebrated in Troy, Michigan. And the issue came when we had an organizer, a woman named Lori Wagner, who was Christian, who'd been organizing this event in Troy for 10 years, and who conceived of it, along with others, many others, conceived of it as a primarily Christian event. Christians prayed, Christians did the speaking, everybody was certainly invited to attend, but it had a very Christian focus to it. That dynamic was disturbed or challenged when Padma Kupa, a Hindu who lived in Troy, Michigan, wanted to make sure that the growing Hindu community in Troy could be represented at this event because she thought the National Day of Prayer is a great idea and we pray. We should all pray together. Those two sorts of sides, neither of which was ever bent on conflict, ended up in conflict as the Christian organizers were very concerned about praying with Hindus and made a request to the Troy City Council that the prayer be a Judeo-Christian day of prayer, one rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And we talked a little bit about the different issues. The one thing that I shelved, among others yesterday, was this issue of religion in the public arena, religion and state, church and state sorts of issues, constitution. I'd like to return briefly to that idea today in terms of this whole idea of the National Day of Prayer. We focused more on the different sides yesterday, Lori Wagner's and Padma Kupa and where they were coming from and trying to figure out where we were in that spectrum. And kind of, maybe taking sides. I know the very first time I read that case study, my thought was, well, Lori Wagner's narrow-minded and she should just get over it and, everybody should pray together. But in more and more thinking about it and in conversations I'd done before and in conversations together, we have to wonder, are they the problem? Or do we need to take sides, or do we really need to interrogate this whole idea of a National Day of Prayer? Why do we have one? Is it necessary? What does it accomplish? What does a National Day of Prayer accomplish in a nation as diverse as the United States? Any ideas, any comments on that whole idea of having a National Day of Prayer?
Oh, it's good press. The president went and the leaders in Congress went. Oh, they've got us in our thoughts and their prayers.
So it's a good PR moment where leaders can look religious.
Exactly.
All right, so the cynical take on things.
Less cynical would be a message about unity and community and that right. we and acceptance.
And that we, look beyond ourselves to mm-hmm. something greater yeah. all together. Yeah, mm-hmm. so that from cynical to, maybe a statement of unity.
Well, maybe prayer actually works.
I wouldn't go there.
Having been to National Day of Prayer in our community several times, and at the time we had some very conservative legislators, and so they were always there praying for what we should vote for. And the flags you were usually brought along, And I believe we should pray for our leaders, but not on somebody else's agenda.
So every day should be a national day of prayer. We just don't need to do it on the public plaza. Yeah, so you'd mentioned yesterday that it became you described it as a flag-waving event.
Yeah.
So that sort of obscured the boundaries about what was Christian and what was American. They sort of became blended. Yeah, and that is often an issue.
It seems to me, though, that if there's a common cause, certainly after 9/11,
right,
people went and prayed. And I think it's very appropriate to have everybody pray about the same thing.
Okay.
I think the problem is when it becomes agendas. That there can be poverty, there can be a disaster, and people gather, and they aren't of all the same faith. That the incident at the university in Virginia, mm-hmm, where all those students were shot, people prayed together who had no religious foundation at all.
That's exactly. But should the government legislate or foster that? Who should be the organizer in that? Is it a government instigated sort of thing? So yeah, so people should pray together, but who should motivate that? Should it be a grassroots, or should it be more from the top?
Well, I know you're wanting to make it short, but the broader issue keeps coming up in things such as should the Ten Commandments be in front of a courthouse, or if you have a Christmas tree, do you then need to have a Star of David? And if you do, what other, before you've got a park that's so full of religious stuff, should anything be there at all? I mean, it's the whole thing is a big issue.
It is, exactly, and this is one of those key things, and it's in the form of something that is not in a statue, so in some ways it's more environmentally friendly. A National Day of Prayer. You're not leaving behind religious debris. as the Ten Commandments or some of these other sorts of things.
Well, I think if you are going to have a National Day of Prayer, then it needs to be exactly that. That you invite everyone from the nation, irregardless of who they are, what
and
they
believe.
And
who they pray to.
Right. If it's going to be nationalized and we aren't a country that chooses a religion.
Our government shall not foster.
Then everyone's got to be.
So it's an all or nothing deal.
That's why I look at it.
So the park should have everything or nothing?
Yes.
Okay, so, all right.
In the immortal words of Walt Kelly, we have met the enemy and they are us. Where does this, we talk about the government, should the government foster these sorts of things? We are. And the government typically doesn't do anything unless there's a thrust from some of us that is politically of some significance. So the question I would have is, where does this sense that we as religious people are in some fragmented way or other, where do we get this idea that we should hijack the government in order to pursue our particular religious agenda?
Use the government as a vehicle.
That's why I use the term hijack.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, of all the stuff the government does, this is probably one of the better things. A lot of what they do I'm kind of against, because they politicize the whole thing, they waste money. Hey, what's wrong with them saying, hey, let's have a National Day of Prayer? That's, to me, like one of the top 10 things they can do, because the rest of it seems like a waste sometimes.
But then why can't they just say, gather in your own synagogues, your own churches, your own temples, and pray? Why does it have to be
if
out
you want to
somebody
get to,
leading it?
And have one particular religious tradition dominate. Yeah.
But wasn't it stated in the case study yesterday that the National Day of Prayer wasn't organized by any government? It was set up by conservative Christians?
Well, it was proposed, and then it was the day was passed by the, in terms of the Constitution. The government passed that in 1988.
Okay.
Yes, so it was proposed by, got enough support, voted on, went into law.
But I thought that it seems to me that it's the local communities who decide how to observe that.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Yeah. So that didn't come down.
The government doesn't legislate that.
So there's the sort of legislation. There is a National Day of Prayer. It's the first Thursday in May. This is how it goes. But then local communities have added to that, because there weren't a lot of rules, and maybe we'll see a lot more changes in that. We'll see, the code book. The lawyers on National Day of Prayer. You can do this, but not that. Can be here, but not there. This long, but not that long. And all those sorts of things. I mean, that's the perfectly logical consequence of government legislation.
Yeah.
So this whole idea, in terms of looking at the day of prayer, maybe, you know, as you said, are things that the government could do. You know, it's not costly. It doesn't involve weapons.
Well, they get a free breakfast, though.
There's a free, you know, the last day of prayer. Prayer breakfast, that's true. And so we're taking a look at these. I want to step back for just a moment and take a look at the definitions of dialogue. All right, what is interreligious dialogue? And it has changed over the years. From the World Parliament on Religions in 1893, the definition had a lot to do with people of different religious traditions getting together. It was convened by Christians, primarily coordinated by Christians. And really the intent underlying, if not explicit, and in some cases it was to say, if we all get together and talk about our traditions and the Christians tell everybody, you know, what they're about, then everybody will eventually come around to our way of thinking, the Christian way of thinking. That was really the goal. And they said, we can be open-minded. And yes, they might need a little time. But if we all talk about it, they'll just see that their religious traditions are just a step on the way to us. And that was, you know, just a very open-minded stance. You know, we can talk to each other, that sort of thing. That was 1893, and that was, you know, the first sort of volleys into interreligious dialogue. Throughout the 50s and 60s is when the dialogue movement took on then a whole new head of steam. Anybody guess why? World War II, the Holocaust. It was Jewish-Christian relations that were really at the center of the dialogue movement in the 50s and in the 60s, and especially leading up to the Vatican II, where the Pope made revolutionary statements about the relationships between Christians and Jews, that Christians were not required to go and proselytize Jews. I mean, they had a whole and powerful tradition. They had a unique relationship with God on their own. So you have these sorts of movements really, they're working themselves out. They're trying to figure out how to talk to each other. A lot of that dialogue, 50s, 60s, 70s, was really based, you know, and I call it, and this is completely simplifying it, so I don't mean to undermine the work that was done, but a lot of list making. All right? I believe this. What do you believe? Okay, we got Jesus. Who do you got? We've got sins, forgiveness of sins. We've got confession. What do you got? We've got an afterlife, balls, many mansions. What do you got? You know, this sort of thing, sort of a checklist. And what you're trying to figure out on your checklist is which things you could agree on, more or less, common ground. That's not a bad idea, because for many people, it was inconceivable that there would be common ground. They saw themselves as so different. So seeking common ground was in many ways a good idea. And then you focus on the areas where you have the most common ground.
Have you read The Faith Club?
The Faith Club, the three women.
The three women, yep. The Jew, the Christian, and the Muslim got together, and they shouted at each other, and they dialogued, and came up with some commonality.
Right, and that's often where dialogue starts, is that trying to find commonality. Yes, I can see you as a person very much like me. We're not so different. We're human together. We have a lot of the same interests. We have a lot of the same, you know, concerns, beliefs, that sort of thing. I think that's an important part of dialogue. In the last maybe 20 years or so, you see that definition of dialogue changing again, and not getting rid of commonality. It's definitely getting rid of that first idea of dialogue that I said. You know, they'll eventually come to Christianity because a lot more people, many more traditions are involved in this sort of dialogue enterprise. But what it has added on to this idea of searching for commonality is going further to take a look at dialogue as a two-way conversation between people of different faith traditions, and it's aimed at relationship between those two, not domination. It's not a power play. I'll show you my stuff, you show me your stuff, we see who wins. All right? It's aimed at, if I talk about myself and my beliefs and my tradition and you tell me about yours, in that process, we may come to be friends. We may learn more about each other. So it's much more mutual, much more an even playing field. Diana Eck also calls it a mutual witness. Christians have a message to share. They can also be witnessed to. That's the new radical part of dialogue that people are not always as comfortable with. Christians have always felt that there's a witness that they have to share, but can they be witnessed to by someone from another faith tradition? What are they supposed to do with this? The process of dialogue today is often described in terms of transformation. You go into dialogue with the other, and you will not come out the same. You will be changed. They will be changed in ways that you can't script. What's intimidating about that?
Change?
Lack of control.
Yeah.
But we've already got it right. Why do we take the risk? Yeah.
Buy money.
Why take the risk? And a lot of people are saying, well, what's there to learn? What's there to, what possibly?
What do they have to teach,
what do they have to teach us?
Well, I was just going to mention one of the ways of dialogue that's going on, at least in Chicago and maybe other places too, is through this organization that Evo Patel has.
Yes.
That you would know, but it basically uses acts, and in fact the book was over there, Acts of Faith, I believe. But he's a young man and there's a lot of young people involved, and so if people can get together and work on a common project.
Right.
Right. So they come in to work on whatever the project is from a variety of situations, and just by working together, there is the chance for dialogue. Not just by, we know it's a little.
But they work together, and in the process of working closely together, sharing space and resources, they begin to know each other. Right. It's through relationship. You cannot enter relationship without change.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And
that's a kind of an interesting thing, and that's why often people are kind of concerned about this. Entering the relationship, the listing sort of dialogue, well, do you got this, we got this, well, we can agree on some things, disagree on, you know, that's a little bit more distant. You sit at a table, you shake hands at the beginning, you shake hands at the end, and you can maybe go your separate ways, learn a little bit more, but this transformational idea of dialogue, which Eboo Patel, especially in working with young people in the United States of different faith traditions, is really aiming at.
Well, the other thing that I hear a lot from people who avoid anything like that is the false prophet rhetoric.
Right.
That it's, you know, if you take this and you listen to it, somehow you're going to be tainted, you're going to be
deceived.
Yeah.
Deceived, yeah. You don't want to dilute or pollute what you've got. You know, don't let anything else in because you've got something good.
Well, thankfully, we Christians all understand things the same way.
Well, at the very beginning of the ecumenical movement, it was usually Christians or Catholics and Lutherans trying to hammer things out, and it's not as if that's been perfectly settled.
In the Middle East, where there's so much conflict, and it's said to be or thought to be religion-oriented, there are many groups of faith encounter. Groups, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, who meet together,
right.
Usually it's women,
mm-hmm.
And in one group they decided, well, they study the holidays of each of the faith traditions, mm-hmm. And celebrate those together. And then they went beyond that, because in the Jewish tradition, you get rid of all leavened products. During Passover, because you have to clean things out. And we've got starving Palestinians. They have very little food because of the occupation. So why not share all the leavened products with the starving Palestinians? And they did that. And in some cases, they were welcomed with amazement. In other cases, they were sort of, they couldn't believe it, and so they closed the door and didn't accept.
It was a sort of shocking exchange, but yeah, how did these get, and but they were working on the basis of relationship. How can
yes.
we navigate these things, especially since we share a small, you know, this space together.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of it is in talking with people of different faiths or ideology in general, is that you're educated and you remove the uncertainty and the fear of the uncertain. You know, because if you don't know what someone else is thinking, there's this natural fear. That, oh, I don't know, you know, because you don't know the facts. Well, if you talk and you become more educated, then it's easier to, you know, to be more comfortable with yourself and with the world and making decisions.
Sometimes. sometimes. And I think that can work for some people. I have students who walk into my intro to Bible class at Luther and say, I've heard that your class is going to shake my faith. And what I have told them, tongue-in-cheek, because after tenure it gets a little bit, I said, if you let me shake your faith, then you don't have much to begin with. But that sense that, because there is that sense that people might be, but some people say, don't shake what I've got.
Well, there's an element of truth to that. I mean, if you are so afraid that your confidence in Christ is going to be destroyed because you learned a little bit about Islam and Hinduism, that says maybe more about your confidence in Christ than it does about either Islam or Hinduism. And, you know, we need in this country, I think, to keep in mind, you know, the need to respect other people's right to their own beliefs, mm-hmm. however misguided we may find them. The First Amendment is still on the books, we can't try to regulate beliefs we don't like out of existence. And finally, if Christ told us to love our enemies, even if we were to concede that these other traditions were somehow our enemies, which is at best debatable,
right.
We would still be obligated as Christians to love them anyway.
Right.
I think one of the confusing point for me anyway is when you have, you know, Jesus' Great Commission, you know, is are we misunderstanding go and make disciples, or is the commission to go make disciples of anyone who doesn't have a faith background already, find those, and those are you, because, you know, it's the whole idea of, well, if you're supposed to be making disciples of others, then who do you make disciples of, and aren't you making a judgment about them and their faith, and what does that tell me I should be thinking about?
The problematic word in that translation is make. Because that's the sense that Christians have really latched onto, aside from all the other gospel texts in Paul, instead of bringing good news, which is the core of the gospel, Christians have focused on the make disciples, which has a very downward, hierarchical sort of thing. You're going to be my disciple whether you like it or not. And you're going to buy what I have to sell. You know, and that sort of thing. And I think we've focused on that, and even subtly, not, I don't think intentionally, but that making piece. But I think the Gospels testify so much more strongly, the Gospel message, to bringing the good news, sharing.
Just sharing what you have with
this
others.
This is what I have. And they might tell you what they have. You know, because I think it's that issue of force that gets in the way. And I think that's where we're getting hung up, especially when we take a look at the collective Gospel message. If I have good news to share it, then let me do that. That doesn't mean that you don't have some good news. But we've always assumed that that is the implication. I've got it, you don't.
Okay.
You know?
This kind of goes out of the Islam, Buddhism, all that kind of thing, the Native American traditions. I have some friends who really have rejected the Christian religion, even though they have been brought up in it, because the Christian schools that they went to treated them so poorly because they were Native American.
Exactly.
And it kind of brings you back to that, by their fruit you shall
know them, exactly. And it's like the speaker at the Buddhist speaker at the Parliament of World Religions, he said, where it says no Japanese allowed here, he said, if this is Christian ethics, then I'd prefer to be a heathen. You know, that sort of sense. And I think a lot of people have that. I need to see some consistency in your, you know, what you say and what you do. And I think that that's happened in many cases for religious traditions, that kind of gap between the ideals and the reality.
Theologian Douglas John Hall has been talking about that as Christians, that maybe our best evangelism strategy right now is to stop speaking the message and start doing the message.
That's
let that be our evangelism.
That is actually the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. They have a director named Rafael Malpica, who is a really, really interesting guy from, I think it's Costa Rica. I might get that wrong. Sorry, Rafael. He and the mission team at the ELCA have kind of revamped this whole idea of mission within the Lutheran Church, and it is now called a mission of accompaniment. You accompany people on their journeys. where they're at by doing, by teaching, by serving, with, as opposed to coming, again, that making sort of thing. But he said it's all about accompanying the other in their journey. And I think that's exactly grounded in that sort of theology that you're talking about. And it's interesting, that kind of model. When he came to present at one of my classes at Lutheran, was talking about that, my students were stunned. They're like, oh my gosh. And like a whole group of them stood to talk to him after class. And they're like, really? I could go teach in Slovakia? And one said, well, you know, I don't even know if I'm Christian anymore. He said, well, before you toss it, come teach with us in Slovakia. See what you learn about yourself. See what you learn about the other. And he's like, the kid was like, you're not rejecting me because I'm not sure? He said, absolutely, who's sure?
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. The students felt so moved by those kinds of statements that it was, I think, a powerful witness just there, as opposed to a more power play sort of thing. The question I want to get to, just one last time. Yep.
Okay. I just in the 70s, I had been away from Christianity for a while, and then came back to a Lutheran church. And this, I don't remember his name, this one man who lived in Evanston, who came to our congregation, he was talking about being in China, and he was inviting people. Mm-hmm. It was an invitation, not, he was a missionary who was actually extending an invitation, not trying to convert.
Right.
And that was so impressive.
It's like the bringing the good news. This is what I have. Maybe it will be good news for you too.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of an interesting sort of idea. Going back to this idea of dialogue, when you enter into dialogue, according to this sort of transformation model, you will not only learn more about the other through relationship, you're going to learn more about yourself, about what you think, about who you are, and so it's transformational in that way as well. In this model of dialogue, it doesn't mean that you're going to come to some sort of resolution, that you're going to agree on issues. You will understand more clearly where the other is coming from, and maybe even where you are coming from, to develop a deeper respect for the other as a human, as a person of faith. Doesn't mean you have to agree with anything that they say, all right, or that they have to agree with you. That isn't the object of it, so it takes a lot of pressure off of it. You know, I think there's so much concern about coming to a consensus or one view, that sometimes we just need to be okay with many views. And this model allows for that.
Isn't it lovely what we learned about the Sikhs on Monday? Those of us who were here, now you understand why they wear a turban. It's out of reverence. And
right.
That wasn't a dialogue, unfortunately, but that changed us all who didn't know that.
And you're like, wow, it's out of reverence. I can respect that. That's a really cool thing.
The most compelling words from that older gentleman, that what his values are, who's going to argue with that?
Who's going to, exactly.
You mentioned that. It's interesting because I'm on the board of Cal Lutheran, and they just hired in their religion faculty a Sikh to teach world religion. And some people don't like that because, where's our... our Lutheran theology, lecture. And but he's going to teach world religion, and some people don't like that whole concept. But I think it's a healthy concept.
Right.
Very.
Learning it from the other as well. So let's take a look at that, just before we turn to our case study. If we take a look at this model of transformation in interreligious dialogue, and this National Day of Prayer, does the National Day of Prayer, in many ways as it's structured, foster these goals? Do we have to pray together to understand each other? Is that what we have to do to figure out, or is that an unnecessary barrier to relationship? Do we need to be required to pray together at the same time, in the same place, in the same words, to enter into a dialogue that could transform us?
I think more than gathering in one place, what really matters is like participation together in things like the interfaith food pantry or things where, you're living out your faith and helping other people.
Maybe for the common good.
For the common
good. And that fits with the ideals of this nation, the common good, things like that. Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting idea. How do we, how do we foster the goals of this sort of transformational dialogue? Now, I had a professor in seminary who'd spent much of his career in Egypt, and he pushed this idea of dialogue even further. He said, if you can't get to the point of being ready to convert, maybe you haven't gone far enough. Yeah, so it's like, and in seminary, you can imagine the whole room went. But he said, yes, his specialty was Islam, and he said, yes, I could convert to Islam, but I didn't. He said, I have remained a Lutheran pastor and professor. He said, but I could. And he's married to a Muslim woman. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know, and so that's kind of an interesting dialogue in terms of how that goes. Now, let's move into our case study today, because this is, I think, kind of interesting. What I've done yesterday, so instead of wasting a million sheets of paper, I have done a synopsis of this case study at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, so we can kind of work through this together. Beginning in 2002, the airport staff at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport became aware that some passengers who were carrying alcohol were being refused taxi service. All right, so sometimes they come out in the plastic duty-free bags where you could see it, that sort of thing. Many of those drivers who refused service were from Somalia. They were Somalian Muslims, and they explained that their faith did not allow them to consume or transport alcohol. Now, this is kind of interesting altogether for people who may not be as familiar with Minnesota and the Twin City area in particular, but Minnesota and Minneapolis-St. Paul has the largest Somali population in the United States, upwards of 40,000. And at least 75% of the taxi drivers there are Somali. All right? So this is no small issue. If you've got 75% of your taxi drivers being Somali, and then many others are Muslims from other countries as well, so you have that idea. Now, of those Somalis that are in Minnesota, at least a third, maybe even more, have come from the brutal conditions in Somalia, civil war, refugee camps, trauma, all those sorts of things, and then they've ended up in Minnesota, hopefully not in the midst of winter, but but that has happened. So you've got this population, and this is, you know, a population that has been, that is hurting. I mean, they're trying to heal from their life stories. So service refusals by taxi drivers are prohibited by the taxi cab ordinance. I didn't include it here. You could refuse on very specific grounds, like if someone was so inebriated that you were fearing for their safety or your safety, that, you know, but the very, very specific grounds upon which you could refuse service. Carrying alcohol or having had alcohol was not considered a reasonable ground to deny service. So what was happening is, with drivers refusing service, that often meant then that they would have to pass up that fare, go to the end of the line, which could mean maybe another 2-hour wait. So you'd lose an entire fare in that whole process. You go to the end of the line. So these taxi drivers were losing fares, which they badly needed to, you know, for their survival, and passengers were really trying situations too. You come out of long flight, it's, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, and you've got brought some wine with you from your trip to Sonoma, Napa Valley, and you can't get a taxi. What are you going to do? And this wasn't good for Minnesota tourism. All of a sudden you have this sort of interesting situation. According to the airport director, Steve Wareham, in his research of this issue, he found that this problem was unique to Minneapolis-St. Paul. He talked to airports all over the U.S. and even in other countries, and was finding out that nobody had this kind of issue on this kind of scale. So he's like thinking, why us? What's the mix? What's going on? All right? And it might be that, you know, this population of primarily, you know, survivors, refugees, sort of that sort of, you know, critical mass. He'd noted that before 2002, and this is the fourth paragraph on your sheet, service refusals in the, and this is MAC, as Minneapolis Airport Commission, began tracking them in 4 categories. The first month they were tracked, in January 2002, there were 82 documented refusals, 70 for alcohol, da-da-da-da-da-da. That started increasing exponentially after that point. So they were getting all these refusals, and the complaints started rolling in.
Do we have any idea of why the taxi drivers in Minneapolis were so predominantly Somalia? Did they own the taxi company?
Yeah, you know, apparently it's a pretty thankless job. It's got flexible hours, and so a lot of these people were really trying to make go to school, and they would often have two jobs. Some of those statistics are in the longer reports I have, but often this was something that would allow them to maybe go to school, get some training, and then like work throughout the night or work strange, you know, kind of fit those sorts of things in, because they were the largest refugee population at that point. For some reason, the large Hmong population in the Twin Cities didn't take to taxi driving. I don't know why, but this population did. And I guess once you get an in, then you know, yeah, I can get a job doing this, and I can make a go of it.
Well, did they agree amongst themselves, or was there someone higher in the church that said, this is what you're going to do?
This is exactly it. No, they didn't agree among themselves, but a lot of them did it because some of their religious leaders were saying, no, you can't consume or transport people who have alcohol. Right. And I'll show you a little bit what kind of disagreement there was in the community. So after 2004, Steve Wareham sought input from the Somali community representatives, Muslim leaders. So he said, okay, what can we do here? And he was very, you know, practical about this and thought we can solve this issue through collaboration. He said, we've solved a lot of issues in the past. We've almost always been able to figure something out where everybody at least is somewhat satisfied. Let me talk to the leaders, see what we can come up with, some kind of compromise. The first thing that they tried was the taxi starter, the dispatcher, would provide bags to travelers in order to cover the wine or other visible alcohol. So it's like that nobody, the taxi drivers couldn't see it. So there'd be special bags. Well, the taxi drivers could see the special bags after a while and would refuse to take those passengers. So that didn't work. But that was the first attempt, all right, to kind of like cover it. So they continued. Again, in 2005, Wareham sought input from local Somali and Muslim leaders on how to improve the quality of service by taxi drivers and how to understand this refusal to transport. You know, what else can we do? The first thing we tried didn't work. All right. He received conflicting advice. This is exactly your question from the Muslim community. So you have one prominent Somali scholar, Dr. Ahmed Samatar. He disputed the driver's claim that their faith did not permit them to transport passengers with alcohol. And he encouraged the airport commission to make a firm rule against alcohol refusals by imposing strict penalties. Now, what was his rationale? He said that if a strict adherence to Muslim law did not, in fact, limit taxi drivers from carrying, especially non-Muslims, with alcohol. All right, and he said that it was bad advice from poorly educated Muslim leaders that was causing this. So that's one Muslim scholar who's saying this. Now, on the other side, you have the Muslim Association of America, or Muslim American Society, and those are two leaders on the other side, and they said, and they were telling their taxi drivers, and the taxi drivers were much more closely affiliated with this Muslim American society, and they said that carrying alcohol constituted a matter of deep faith conviction for their people, and asked the airport commission accommodate the driver's desire to avoid transporting alcohol. So they, you know, consulted the scholars and the leaders in the community, and they get these two, you know, this range of advice. So then what do you do? Then what do you do? So exactly, it's not, it's like if you ask the Christian community, what do Christians think about, you're going to get a lot of different answers, you know. So this issue continued to be a problem with more and more complaints coming in. And I've listed a typical complaint on the page 2 here, March 29th, 2006. Here's the complaint that came in. My wife and I needed a cab from the airport to Apple Valley. The starter directed us to a cab. After loading most of our luggage, the driver noticed I was carrying duty-free liquor and refused to transport us. The next three cabs also refused. The starter came out and finally located a driver who would take us. We were very unhappy about this abysmal treatment by four cab drivers. We request that you take action against the company and the driver and draft a policy to prevent this behavior in the future. This was the tone of now many complaints that were beginning to roll in. So Wareham and his colleagues then thought, and this is 2006, okay, we need to revisit this again. We need to make expand or enlarge the process of decision makers. Because before, he and a couple of his colleagues were trying to work with leaders of the Muslim community, and that didn't result in resolution. So they tried to figure out how to design a process where there'd be a lot more collaboration with taxi drivers, owners, dispatchers, all along leaders from the community, and try to get as many people involved as possible. And so on May 11th of that spring, they had their first meeting. And at that meeting, it didn't go quite as well as Wareham had hoped, because right after the initial comments, taxi drivers felt that for too long they had been suffering financially for exercising their religious rights. All right. So they had said, and actually at this meeting, the religious leaders themselves, a lot of them weren't there. They wanted to bring in more of their local leaders as opposed to just the Muslim American Society and scholars. So they said, we want the people from our mosques. And so expand the meeting, expand this process further. Second meeting, a month later, June 8th. At that meeting, the leaders that came brought with them a fatwa, which is an edict, kind of what Muslims are required to obey, that said our drivers cannot transport people with alcohol or consume it, and that means they have to refuse these fares. Now, Wareham and his colleagues were really surprised, because they're hoping to do a little bit more collaboration on this, and he said, right at the outset, at the beginning of this meeting, they get this fatwa, and that kind of limits conversation. So they did try to do some brainstorming at that meeting. Started that process. They agreed to meet again June 29th, so at the end of June, and that was primarily brainstorming. Well, if we've got this fatwa and we've got passengers that need cabs, what are we going to do? And 75% of our taxi drivers are Somali. How are we going to do this? So all kinds of different things. All kinds of ideas. Allowing the Muslim taxi drivers who would transport people with alcohol, letting them do it. Others who didn't want to, didn't have to. The other idea was putting a light on top of your cab if you're willing to transport people with alcohol. And basically, that is the idea. There are all kinds of others that were launched, but that was the idea that they really went with. So in August, they came up with a plan, put a light on top of your taxi, and they designed this whole pilot program. We'll start in November, we'll run it for 6 months, we'll reevaluate at that point, see how it's going. But after they published or released this plan, the media and everybody in the community started totally getting involved. So the situation itself intensified. What happened is, in fact, that the pilot never was put into place because there was so much outcry. By people in the Twin Cities, people from around the United States, the newspapers, the New York Times had editorials on it, the New York Post, everybody had their say, all right? And so where they'd come up with this basic idea, the memorandum of understanding, and that involved putting lights on top of the cabs, that was sort of pulled off the burner even before it had a chance to get going, all right? So things continued to sort of ramp up, and on the second to last paragraph, you see the kinds of concerns and attention this was getting. October 10th, the New York Post ran a piece by Daniel Pipes, which cited the airport's proposed accommodation as Sharia in America. So Islamic law in America, and we're being too accommodating sort of thing, and described a slippery slope leading to discrimination by Muslims against homosexuals, Jews, uncovered women, and others. The airport commission was deluged with 800 emails expressing anger and outrage. So all of a sudden, this stuff was pouring in. October 11th, airport commission announced a decision to withdraw that plan. A seamless solution had not been found. The only thing they could agree on is that the Somali Muslim community had suffered a lot because they were losing fares and their reputation. Of Muslims, particularly in Minnesota, had taken a huge hit. Stereotypes that were already problematic were now heaped on that. Not only do we have a problem with Muslims after 9/11, but now these Muslims aren't even doing their jobs, sort of thing. So it was just sort of insult to injury. That's kind of, and they didn't actually come to a perfect solution. I think it's been very much patchwork since then, how to figure out how to get enough taxi drivers to transport people, but it hasn't been thoroughly resolved. All right. So, couple of different issues. Again, just like yesterday's case study, a million things that we could dissect, all right? This idea of Muslim taxi drivers refusing to provide service. Now, instead of focusing on them, is there something from your faith tradition that you could not do based on what you believe? So before we jump to what they don't feel they're allowed to do, is there something that you would draw the line in the sand and say, I can't do that because I am a Christian, because I am a Hindu, because I am...
Well, there have been arguments about, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, Catholic practitioners refusing to provide abortion services, the morning after pill, things like that. You know, as a Lutheran, if I were running a drugstore, would I sell birth control to someone I knew wasn't married? If I did, would I somehow be endorsing and teaching about sex that I didn't believe in personally? At some point, you know, there has to be a sort of a universal understanding of these faith-based service denial situations, and what is good for one tradition pretty much has to be good for another in terms of the legal implications. We can't say that it's not okay for a Somali taxi driver to refuse to carry alcohol, and if he does, his license to drive a cab is revoked, while at the same time we turn around and say that it is okay for a Christian pharmacist to deny products that are on the shelf or refuse to even put them on the shelf.
Or order them, even. Yeah, that was one of them.
There has to be some general approach to these situations.
Right.
You can't just be picking on one group or another.
And in a nation with so much diversity, there isn't one sort of group that you can say, well, we'll just adopt this rule, sort of thing.
Well, I think as a Christian, to act as I believe, lying, cheating, stealing, stabbing in the back a coworker to advance, climb up the ladder over him or her, ethical actions on my own part.
Doing something a boss wanted you to do, although you knew it wasn't right. Yeah, you know, and those are some of the sorts of pieces.
I think the deeper question is, if I decide to do something, or to avoid doing something on the basis of my faith stance, who bears the burden?
Who bears the burden, yeah.
My sense of how it ought to be is if I decide not to, well, when I was in confirmation back in the last millennium, dancing was not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have borne that burden because my wife would like me to be a better dancer. If I choose to not carry alcohol in my cab, then I should bear the burden, not the person who's bearing the alcohol. That would be my personal approach to that.
Right. Yeah, and in some ways they see it as perhaps a different, you know, you frame the issue in that way, and perhaps, and that they see this law coming from Allah, that they're directly responsible to Allah, then they would put Allah would trump the passenger.
And if they lose money on the basis of that, that's part of their service to Allah.
It seems to me that if you choose a job that has that possibility, you assume the risk. Or you could just say, I'm not going to work at the airport.
What do you do, though, in situations, these are refugees, language abilities, education, and opportunities are very limited. You're in a place where you need to provide something for your family, and this is the job you can get. A lot of times we can't eliminate these outlying circumstances from those sorts of things. These people have to make a living somehow.
I wonder if sometimes, as a country, we are trying to regulate too much. What's wrong with having a pharmacy that will provide the birth control for unmarried if they believe in it, and a pharmacy that won't? What and why do we, you know, what's wrong with the passengers coming in and choosing not to carry alcohol because they want a taxi sooner?
Right. I guess, and then you go, then legal, actually we go to the next step. What about in a small town in Kansas where there's one pharmacy?
Yeah.
Well, I doubt the dialogue is any better, I don't know.
Right.
But the Somali community took an awful hit last summer in Minneapolis, where a large apartment complex where a number of these Somali families live, a man continually raped and beat his wife in the hallway, and nobody called the police or blew the whistle. Well, of course, that was an enormous news item, and the answer in the Somali community was, well, it probably shouldn't have happened, but after all, the wife is just property, essentially, was what they said. So I doubt the dialogue is
going. And then there's been the additional issue of Somali, young Somali men being recruited for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And that's made national news. So yeah, this is this is tricky.
When I first read your synopsis, I got to the final or next to last paragraph, and it just struck me that the powers that be in Minneapolis had come up with a reasonable solution.
Right.
And it was stymied because folks came with their own agendas, mm-hmm. came to the table and were able to influence things.
What do you do with drivers who are answerable in their community? They've got these dual pressures. I've got to make a living, and in order to keep my community connections, I have to do what this leader says. I might not agree with them, so do I face, you know, being ostracized by my community or losing fares? There, you know, and that issue too. Everything, you know, is so frustrating. But yeah, it seemed reasonable, you know?
And wasn't given a chance to even try because
yeah.
Somebody from New York didn't like it.
Yeah. And everybody else started voicing opinions and getting involved. Yeah.
Well, I think I had the same reaction that I started thinking about it. What they're talking about is that also a part of the tradition is women need to have covered heads and so on. So the question is if they're allowed to make this decision and have the whole city bend to this one part of their law, then what if somebody else says, well, you know what, here's three other points of my law and you've already made an accommodation. And in the same way you talk about the, you know, why can't you have a drugstore who goes by their own, conscience, you've had the same situation when you talked about dealing with races and sexism and all
that. Yeah, well, we won't let this race enter here.
But yeah, so it's a bigger issue than you can't just say everybody can make their own decision
right.
when you're dealing in a public situation. What you can do in your own home
is
different than once you go into the public arena and you open a public store or you have a public business.
We have a couple more minutes, so let's communal stuff. They did have reports that after this, things came in, gay couples being refused service. So all of a sudden, it was going exactly there. It wasn't at the level, but still, where do you kind of go with this? I'll go here and then.
This question of transporting alcohol, it's not the driver's alcohol.
Right.
I mean, that's a technicality, too, between who knows what's in people's suitcases.
No
they
kidding.
They may be transporting who knows what.
But they didn't put it in a suitcase.
But the thing is, and that's precisely the debate within the Islamic community. The one scholar said, hey, this has nothing to do with us. If they're going to transport alcohol, it's not our thing.
Right.
He said, but there's a debate within the Islamic community, and Christians know well that there are debates. I mean, just take a look at the abortion issue in the United States. And you're precisely right, and depending on kind of who wields the influence. Who had, run over here, yeah, yellow, and then.
I just was thinking that today's story, the Somalis are yesterday's Lori Wagner.
Yeah.
And I find myself much more trying to be understanding of the Somalis than I was yesterday with Lori.
Right.
And I just think that's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
You're kind of thinking, okay, my kind of leanings are going there.
Well, I just find myself thinking it absurd to believe that because somebody wants to operate a business in the United States, they have to offer every service that anybody anywhere in the world offers through that business. And the first example that comes to mind for me is I recently have started occasionally having a Mediterranean meal at a little cafe that offers only halal. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, should they have to offer non-halal because they're a public business, they're offering a public service?
Who had their hand up?
What is it?
Halal is the way of butchering the meat.
Okay.
It's like kosher.
All right. I know a young Somali man that was kind of on the fringe of all of this, and somebody was talking about how does it happen that all the Somalis are... Well, in his case,
it was a kind of a extended multi-group family that was together, and they had taxis, and they would just hand off the taxi so that somebody was doing it 24 hours a day. So economically, it was a big thing. But he got out of it, and his take on it, and obviously wasn't, you know, I don't know, conservative Muslim, but he felt that this group, that it had less to do with religion than it had with power, because they were, it was kind of like, he equated it with the right, kind of the prayers, you know, there's certain things.
The right wing.
And you had, you, if you did not believe this, you were out of this, and it was a power, a political power thing.
Right. Well, I think when we talk about religion, we can't separate out power and politics and all this. We sort of think, like to think of religion as this sort of pure thing apart from culture, power, politics, all those sorts of things. They're always intricately woven together. So there are always power plays going on. But yes, and that perhaps is taking precedence.
Just taking a step back, it seems like part of the case study that I was looking at was the airport director and how effectively, in the end, not effectively.
He seemed
kind of covered his bases, and I thought it was extending as many options as possible. So maybe that's something to take away as
dialogue. When I read this again, I went to Jody's session last night on community building and the things that he talked about, going to talk to the people, getting people involved in the process, the locals, having buy-in, you know? And it seemed like, after that session, when I read that again this morning, that he was doing those things. I don't know what you thought about that, Jody, in terms of, you know, let's work on this collaboratively. Let's see what we've got. Let's see, you know? And it seemed as if he wasn't trying to be heavy-handed.
Yeah, I agree. I also think that I would completely agree with the people who said that the people who screwed this up were outsiders.
Yes.
We might want to just come back and say, look, we're here at this airport in Minneapolis, and we are Minneapolis people, and we've got a couple things we want to try here. We're going to try it no matter what the New York Times says.
That's a really good, because outside media, Fox News also did a thing, and once they get involved, they just said the Islamization of America, and then they had Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, this sort of soulful thing. So you've got outsiders, the Muslim American Society, people in New York, all these folks from across the country, everybody has their say, but they aren't there.
Something that I think is important, I'm frequently getting, one of the reasons they get a lot of responses, somebody sends an email around saying, this is happening, send your opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I do respond to that, and I think it's important to pay attention, what do I know about this? Do I really want to criticize this when I don't know what
I'm not
I'm
there.
Right,
unless it's something you understand in terms of the issue. But yeah, that sense of outsiders coming in and wanting to have their say in a very local issue, because what I thought was remarkable is that this is the only airport. This was, if it was a national problem, then you deal with it differently. This was a local thing. Wareham, the airport director, even talked to some of the cab drivers, the guy who'd been a cab driver in Cairo. And he said, I didn't have this problem in Cairo. This problem in Minneapolis.
Is it possible that during this that there was some agitation that maybe somebody was trying to break the hold of the Somalis on the campuses?
I didn't see that in the writing, but there weren't, from what I can understand about the cab industry, there were not a lot of contenders to get into it. There was not a lot, no, they weren't lining up around the streets, you know, around the block. Maybe other industries, not this one.
Right.
Any other comments? Yep.
It seems like we do have to get to the source, because, I mean, a Western approach would be to think of a solution, a clever solution, like delivery. We'll have a new area of business, and they'll drop off their alcohol here and be delivered, but I think it's about voice and power.
Right.
And so that's where you have to really, I think, drill down if you're ever going to find a solution, because it's not about a clever fix.
No, it's about,
just emerges something else.
You need to have people feeling like they have a voice in this conversation.
Exactly.
So the Somali drivers, regardless of where they stand and who they're listening to, seem to need to be able to be participants in this process, and to close them out saying, well, you're not educated, you're ignorant, you're just, you know, you're being manipulated, isn't enough. They're driving us.
Yeah.
What a wonderful message it would be if Anglos and Somalis, with political and religious leadership in the Twin Cities, could say to the rest of the country, we're together on this.
Yes,
the Somalis and the Anglos think the same way about this, and we're going to try to work it out, and we'll try these lights and some other kinds of things. But the message to the rest of the country is, you're not going to divide us.
Mm-hmm. Butt out. We'll work this out.
That's right.
Yes, we can. We like to think that every problem has a solution.
Right.
And yeah. Some problems don't have a very neat solution.
Well, what I think is, again, what we're talking about, some problems have many solutions. You don't need just one. If you try to find the silver bullet, you're going to run into trouble. What if a problem can be solved in many ways? I think that is far more reasonable, but we like to have the sense that you've got to have just one.
How does an agency like the Metropolitan Airport Commission figure out who speaks for the community? Just like me as a Christian, and I'm sure everyone in this room from what I've been hearing, that if you see conservative Christian whatever mm-hmm. in the news, and if you were to go up to someone and say, I'm a Christian, there's a fear you're going to be painted with that brush, yeah. That you know the distaste for people spoiling everyone's fun and right. You know heated.
Well, that is precisely the problem. Who do you talk to in the community? How do you figure out who to talk to? Who is
hope,
who are the leaders? And you talked about that yesterday. Who are the natural leaders in a community? How do you talk to them? Who are the people that in the community that the others respect and that sort of thing? That's tough.
Yeah, how do you know
it takes some research.
Right.
Well, it takes immersion. It takes some time is the thing. And a lot of times we're on deadlines. We've got a meeting in 6 weeks. We need to have this worked out because it's on the agenda.
Right.
You know, and that kind of becomes problematic. Yeah, you had your hand.
It's interesting to note that the process broke down mm-hmm. once the max half of the deal fell apart.
Right.
The max said it had to be seamless.
Right. Seamless.
It had
one.
To be seamless, okay? When that wasn't accomplished, the other half of the agreement was off the table, right?
So the idea of many solutions.
Right, to accommodate the drivers.
Right.
You know,
so they couldn't, if they wanted to like streamline solution, because
right.
That's a good business model, according to some. But are there business models which accommodate particularity?
Well, you help solve the problem by meeting with people that think the same way you do.
Right, right. That's what I try to do. That's what I mean. That's why my kids are such a problem. They just don't think the same way, you know? I think that, you know, those are some of the issues you kind of try to figure out. How do you get in to kind of take into account people's needs and come up with many different options? Walmart's doing it now. I was in a Walmart in Yakima, and it's 60% Hispanic. Wow, they've got a whole different product line than the Walmart Superstore in Decorah, Iowa. There are some similarities, but it's really different. I mean, you can get in from food to all kinds of other things. They are taking into account the particularity. Walmart used to say, this is what we're sending to all of our stores across America. You all get the same thing. Then they said, you know, why do we have to do that? You know, well, exactly. And maybe at Minneapolis Airport, they could say, well, maybe we can make money by being a little bit more creative.
But talking about the same, you know, different kinds of solutions, it seems like the duty-free shops could explain to people, put it in your suitcase, you know.
Yeah, that might not be true.
Yeah, there might be some ways, or these are some of the risks, or that sort of thing. Any other comments that we want to make before breaking for lunch?